new playground tucked in a wooded corner of Roanoke Park looks like something out of a fairy tale. A rope castle as tall as the trees around it, a bridge over a sand pit. It's getting some good reviews from kids.
What do you like about the park, Kaden?
I like that.
The zip line?
And that.
But this playground is making some grown-ups a little nervous.
I'll probably try it later, maybe. I guess it's strong enough for a man. I don't know.
Yeah, that's probably it. It's the zip line that can't handle him. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about playgrounds, specifically why grown-ups are so skittish about them, even though the ones we played on were way scarier than anything you'd see today. Plus, a movement to bring back the element of risk to the sandbox. I'm not just talking about scary-looking ladders up to the slides either. Some playgrounds in Europe provide kids with combustible materials so they can start fires if they feel like it. Also, saws. More on that later. Let's meet our guests. Daniel Serta, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Gina?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Daniel is a regular on this show. He's an urban design guy with us from Insight Planning. We've also got mom blogger Tanya Blythe in the studio. She's no stranger to playgrounds. Welcome to the show, Tanya.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So how do the playgrounds you see today compare to the ones you grew up playing on yourself? Tanya, we'll start with you.
I think the point you made about how they've almost become too safe is kind of the first thing that comes to mind. As I was thinking about this, we spend a lot of time on wooden structures, metal structures. So you're talking about rust, you're talking about loose nails sometimes, but
splinters,
yes, frequent splinters. But we survived and we had fun, and we didn't know
any better.
What kind
of fun did you have? I mean, what do you? Can you describe it in some more detail from the kid's eye view?
Sure. I think adventurous. I was never afraid to climb something and then jump off. I was never afraid to, you know, spin around something and see how fast I could go or how far I could jump. Now I think we're much more cautious and kind of keeping that watchful eye on our kids to make sure they don't do anything too crazy, you know.
In defense of that watchful eye,
sure.
I did dare my younger brother to jump off of something, as you were saying you were not scared to do as children.
Right.
He was five. He broke his arm.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't cool.
There's always going to be that one horror story, right?
Daniel Serta, what about you? What differences do you notice?
Well, the biggest difference I notice is that the equipment's different, but my perspective is fundamentally different as a parent versus when I was a kid. I was a little skittish. I've got an extreme fear of heights, and so I was always really skittish about climbing up really high on things, though I did like to climb on stuff. I remember Shawnee Park, the neighborhood park in Armourdale where I grew up, had a, I think it was a Korean War cannon in the park that was just there, and it had replaced a Spanish War cannon that I think was contributed to the war effort during World War II, I found out later. That was about as high as I would go. I was climbing up toward the turret of a cannon. But, you know, I had friends that would climb trees. And we had jungle gyms in our school playground that were metal and probably 10, 15 feet high. I wasn't climbing to the top of those, but a lot of my friends were. You know, you think about it fundamentally differently
as Do you think that you were encouraged to challenge yourself beyond it just by those structures being there and other kids enjoying them in your presence? Or no?
Maybe a little bit. It's interesting because the one thing actually that has helped me moderate a little bit is doing some extreme things. Like I climbed a pyramid in Mexico one time. Turned out to be in the middle of a tropical rainstorm that I didn't know was coming because I wasn't listening to my wife while she was trying to warn me because I was so focused on trying to get to the top of this pyramid. But I don't know that it did when I was a kid, but again, my point is, as a parent, you think about things fundamentally differently than you did as a kid. My daughter is 6 years old, has no fear of heights. She has no fear of climbing anything. I took her to an indoor gym last week. She climbed up on an apparatus that was probably 10 or 15 feet high, and I was about 20 feet away when she jumped down off of it. And I just, you know, my stomach fell out, and then she ran around and ambled back up to the top like it was nothing. So I do think as parents, we become a little excessively cautious. That's a broader theme.
I want to get to that.
The changes.
But can I ask you, like, can we be specific about
Are there structures that some of our listeners who don't have kids might remember from playgrounds of their youth that are just not present anymore? I mean, I was recently looking for monkey bars. That's a long story, but yeah, they're getting hard to find.
Absolutely.
What else? I mean, do they still have merry-go-rounds, tire swings?
Well, I mentioned jungle gyms. Those are difficult to come by. The merry-go-rounds are very difficult to come by, though there are a few parks that have them. I remember it happening to friends of mine, you know, people sort of getting stuck underneath them and getting hurt. But we definitely went through a period, I think it probably started in the late 80s, early 90s, where liability started becoming a really profound concern, especially for public agencies. And a lot of those older types of equipment, a lot of them were probably reaching the end of their useful life anyway, but they were removed and not replaced. And what replaced them was probably a little less interesting to kids.
Sure, I would agree with that. Seesaws are one that come to mind that, you know, we saw a lot as kids, but then as thinking back on them now with that parent eye, kids fall off.
It's a catapult
for the little ones. Kids get their fingers pinched in the little mechanism in the middle. So, yeah, definitely some high danger there.
But do you lose, I mean, I wonder, I didn't think of myself as learning physics when I was riding on a seesaw, but when you think about the fact that it is a catapult and that you are gaining a basic understanding of weights balancing each other and things like that, I mean, there does seem to be a usefulness there. Unlike the tire swing, I haven't seen one of those in a long time, but those were essentially vomit machines.
For sure. For sure.
I'm sure our listeners have noticed that playgrounds aren't the testing grounds they used to be. You've got that rubberized pavement that cushions your fall, and the unforgiving metal and wood of our youth has been replaced by plastic. But we're starting to see adventure playgrounds like the one we visited in Roanoke Park earlier in the show. There's also one in Skerritt Renaissance. They're part of a new movement to bring back risk-taking and exploration. What do you think that's about? Do you think that, I mean, what's inspiring this?
What I hope is inspiring it is just an increased desire to encourage learning in our kids and maybe kind of get out of that very structured type of this is all you have to climb on and think about and do. Getting kids in an environment where they can get their hands messy and kind of use their minds to create their own fun, I think is kind of what may be driving it.
Have you been to one?
I have not yet. I'm really excited to.
Have you?
I've been to the playground that was referenced in the earlier segment.
What was it like to watch your kids playing there?
My older kids, I just sort of tended to look away a little bit. My little one wanted to climb the rope apparatus, and I did not let her. And there's a very simple reason for that. We have a 3-inch rule in building codes about openings that are larger in diameter than a 3-inch sphere because small kids can fall through. That apparatus has openings that are probably, I don't know, 18, 24 inches.
So this is
diameter.
A cautionary tale for kids out there. Don't have parents who know design code.
Exactly.
Playgrounds have been shaping and reflecting how we view childhood in America for centuries. In a few minutes, we'll dive into that history as we continue to explore the current tension between exploration and safety. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard, where we've been talking about how lame playgrounds have been getting over the years. I mean, how safe. There's a new movement to bring risk-taking and exploration back to the sandbox, but the newer, riskier playgrounds, known officially as adventure playgrounds, make some of today's parents a little nervous. Daniel Serta, this isn't the first shift we've seen in playground trends. Can you give us the history of the playground in American communities?
You know, one of the things that's so interesting to me is how tied up in the history of the evolution of cities, and especially immigration into cities, and really sort of the mass, you know, agglomeration of a lot of very different people in very dense, congested quarters, how much of a role that played in the early playground movement. There was a lot
of... The early playground movement, when are we talking about?
Late 19th century, 1880s, 1890s is when it started. What's interesting is that the formal sort of organized playground movement, it didn't start till a little over a century ago. It was right after the turn of the 20th century that national organizations were created. There was actually a national association called the Playground Association of America that was chartered in 1906.
So in the late 18th, or in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
What constituted a playground? I mean,
well, the first were very highly structured and highly organized. So the issue that the reformers that were promoting this, and these folks were involved in a lot of different movements involving everything from immigration, civic education, the City Beautiful movement, a range of issues at the time, especially social reform. It included people like Jane Addams, who founded Hull House in Chicago, which was essentially a sort of a civic education center for newly arrived immigrants. And cities, the model was in Chicago, but it fashioned trends in other cities as well. But the basic idea was, you know, cities lack spaces, adequate spaces in which children could play. So we need to set aside, deliberately set aside green spaces. But to go beyond that, the idea was we need very highly structured play, and it's part of a combination of civic education of children in terms of understanding basic social relationships, developing trust in one another, learning, you know, team building skills and sort of interpersonal relationships with other individuals. A large part of it is an emphasis on health. There was a lot of concern about the health conditions in these congested quarters of cities. And this is when you see sort of organized calisthenics emerge as a movement for the first time. One of the most influential figures in all of this was a gentleman named Luther Gulick, who was a doctor who was eventually became director of the Springfield, Massachusetts YMCA. And he had this entire triad, which became a formative element not only in the development of the YMCA, but also the Boy Scouts of America and later the Girl Scouts as well. This sort of mind, body, you know, social dimension of everything people were trying to do. And the idea was, you know, there are a lot of serious health issues. Exercise is fundamental to good health. But also there was a very strong emphasis on highly structured play, supervised play. Literally, you know, you did not play on these playgrounds without direct supervision by coaches and educators. And the idea
was
this is
almost like a PE
class. It is. And it was, again, it's the emergence of physical education sort of as a structured part of it. It's happening at the same time that the formal movement for public education throughout the United States is taking hold. So it's part of a lot of other broader trends that are happening that are largely a reaction to all of the negative sides of the industrialization and the mass growth of major cities in the United States.
How do different, you mentioned immigration, I'm wondering how different communities, they're not just different time periods and how those time periods view children and the child-parent relationship, but there are also different cultures who view that differently, who all come together in this country. I mean, I've been to a neighborhood in New York where there was an empty playground. That is a very sad sight. Mm. But I mean, the reason it was explained to me that the community that lived there viewed play kind of negatively. And so there were families with children standing right near the playground, but the playground was just desolate.
Yeah. Well, that's a slightly different issue than the concern at the time. The concern at the time was in the major industrial cities, everybody worked, including children. We forget about that. This is before child labor reform happened in the early 20th century. So kids typically were sort of, you know, free-range kids, if they were even that, till they were about 10 or 12 years old. And it was not atypical that kids in industrial cities, immigrant backgrounds, working class folks, were heading off to the factories. They were working in the textile mills and that sort of thing when they were 12, 14 years old. Many women worked, you know, as laborers in industrial cities as well. So the concern of a lot of the reformers, and I should say, these reformers were generally the elite of these major cities. They came from, you know, the wealthier classes, so to speak. The concern with a lot of them was that children were largely unsupervised, that they were not receiving sort of a civic education, so to speak. They weren't learning basic civic ideals like, you know, cooperation and understanding sort of the role of authority and that kind of thing. But the point in all of it was that they needed this as a kind of combination of mind, body, you know, almost spiritual education in the case of Gulick, who was involved in the YMCA.
So you can look back on the late 19th, early 20th century and see that what was happening in playgrounds was a reflection of a need for kids to have more space and movement in an increasingly industrialized world. Can you step outside of today and see this what I consider to be a real tension in many aspects of the child experience today, mm-hmm. between research and safety and what will have the best possible, you know, results, what will protect our little cherubs, and over here the sort of a memory of what childhood is actually like and a desire to let kids be kids and to allow risk.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's two major trends that are shaping a lot of what's happening today. One is that there is a lot of concern, particularly in public health sectors, about childhood obesity levels, which have really skyrocketed in the United States. There's a lot of concern about sedentary behaviors and sedentary lifestyles. A lot of that is a function of, you know, 30 years or so of everything from, you know, when I was a kid and getting, you know, be a teenager, MTV to and television to now it's internet. And I heard the phrase screen time this morning. The concern is that kids are largely living sedentary lives. They're not adequately active, and they're also not active in a way that allows them to explore.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about playgrounds. You may have noticed that they've grown increasingly safe over the years, but we may be seeing the early stages of a shift back to risk-taking and exploration on the playground, as well as the potential for scraped knees and bruised egos that comes right along with that. Our guests are design guru Daniel Serta, who's been giving us the history of the playground in this country, and mom blogger Tanya Blythe. Tanya has two children as of her own, as well as two foster children in her care. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm interested in the current generation of parents. We survived and really enjoyed our own childhoods, which were devoid of a lot of the protective measures that are standard these days. Yet we're afraid to let our own kids do the things we loved doing ourselves. My kid is 3 months old, and I'm already guilty of this. Why the discrepancy between what we did as kids and what we're comfortable letting our kids do now?
I think one thing I hear a lot of from moms is that our parents didn't know better. So the idea that we have better information, better knowledge about maybe what's harmful to our kids.
We sure have more of it, whether it's better or not.
Absolutely. A better awareness of our surroundings, those types of things. So I think more than anything, I think that's kind of what's driving it, is this idea that we are better equipped to make better decisions for our kids. Whether that's right or wrong, probably, you know, who knows at this point, but I think that's kind of what's driving it at this point.
You use the word inundated. That's a great way to describe it, because part of what it reinforces is an exaggerated sense of risk. The best example of that is stranger danger. I mean, stranger abductions are exceedingly rare. There's so many more things you're likely to be harmed by as a kid. The most dangerous thing any parent does with their child every day is put them into a car. Without doubt. I mean, more kids are killed and severely injured in automobile accidents. I mean, it's factors of magnitude well beyond any kind of stranger abduction. But we're inundated with information about that kind of thing. The same is true with a lot of other risks. I mean, everything has a warning label, right? And, you know, we perceive there to be a lot of risk in things that, again, people took for granted a while back. And there was risk in some cases. But it's the overwhelming volume of information, I think, that tends to make people very leery.
We talk about this as though today's parents come in just one flavor or variety.
Sure.
But
sure.
I'm curious about whether you guys think that parenting may be polarized in the way that everything else kind of seems to be these days. I mean, are there parents who are sort of in reaction to this trend? Is there the mainstream risk-averse parent and then some other kind of parent bubbling up under the surface?
Well, the idea of what you're talking about is best exemplified by Lenore Eskenazi, who wrote this book, Free Range Kids, talking about her own experiences with her children in New York City. And you hear about these things that happen occasionally, you know, parents being investigated by Child Protective Services because they allow their kids to ride the subway unaccompanied, things like that. You know, how could you possibly do that?
Or walk to the park alone.
Or walk to the park alone, you know, or traverse near a busy highway, whatever the case is. Again, we have these kind of countervailing forces out there, but there's absolutely a movement growing of people that have said, you know what, we need to stop for a minute and let kids be kids. I mentioned before this issue about childhood obesity. That's one of the drivers. It's, you know, there's a focus that there's been too much absorption of kids sort of into consumer culture, everything from watching too much TV or being on the internet too much or playing video games too long.
Or just go sit right there. You'll be safer that way.
Exactly. Right? and the idea that, you know, kids really need to be kids. They need to be engaged. And again, that goes back to long-held theories about play and exploration and the development of the mind, really.
Well, let's get back to the playground. I mean,
this show is inspired by the Adventure Playground, which is new in Kansas City, but it's been in Europe and New York for a while. Mm-hmm. And I've watched video footage from some of the more extreme examples from these places. Sure. And it seems in some cases, I mean, it goes beyond danger as a possible side effect and more into this deliberate ingredient. Saws, machetes, hammers, fire pits. These playgrounds are like teenage parties in a parent's worst nightmare for right. children. Do you think we've been so extreme in our protectiveness that now the pendulum might be swinging in kind of an extreme way in the other direction?
I think so. The idea that, you know, as I was thinking about this, the idea that you would be comfortable with even older age kids, you know, coming into maybe their early teenage years, that you would be comfortable just setting them out in a scenario where there's saws and, you know, all these different things where they could definitely injure themselves is kind of a strange thing to imagine. Having said that, I think there is probably a middle ground where you can find some comfort in just letting them explore and try new things that are kind of out of the box and don't have an instruction manual or a parent kind of hovering over them saying, this is what your defined, you know, look of fun has to be.
Because the idea is that the kids are using these materials to build their sure. own structures for fun.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. And I think it encourages creativity and learning and teamwork and all of those things that you want to see your kids enjoying. But, you know, like you said, the pendulum going too far to the other side, I think, is definitely a risk at that point.
Is there a local playground that you think strikes a good balance? You were saying that there's probably a middle ground.
Sure. One that comes to mind, there's actually two in the Northland, one in Kearney and one in North Kansas City, that have really large play structures that I think really do kind of encourage that exploring mentality, kind of maybe not as cautious as some of your smaller maybe neighborhood playgrounds.
What are the signs of that? I mean, how does that manifest itself?
How do you mean?
What do you see at these playgrounds that tells you this is a middle ground?
Sure. The one in North Kansas City that comes to mind, Dagg Park, has a fence around it. And what's interesting about that is that as you look at it in the space that it's surrounded by, it's, you know, got a police station and a library and businesses around. It doesn't have the feel of a park, but it's very structured and confined and lets the kids have fun in that, you know, very
within
small
a prescribed
area.
Space.
Absolutely.
I'm Gina Kaufman, back with KCUR's Central Standard after 3 months on maternity leave. So it's fitting that today's show is about new trends in playground design. And what those trends say not about kids, but about the people raising them. Now, we've heard, you know, in defense of the kind of playground that is more protective, there is research now. There is knowledge that it's very hard to ignore something that tells you that there is a risk that could put your child at danger. On the other hand, in defense of less structured play, Daniel Serta and I were just remembering some of the play of our childhoods. For me, a game called Pillow Guys that involved two siblings ricocheting another off of a bed from underneath pillows again and again and again. Daniel, what about your game?
We made up a game called Ice Ball, which was usually when it was getting a little bit warm after a heavy snow, and it was a way of playing baseball during the winter, basically. But we would use a wiffle ball bat, and we would sort of crunch together what were almost ice balls. The snow was getting a little crunchy. And the objective was, you know, you would pitch just like in baseball. You'd hit, if you connected, the ball would basically explode, but you had to run to the base. And when you're running to the base, the pitcher had a mound of additional snowballs that they would then throw at you as you were running to the base.
Nice. So things being pummeled at you.
Yeah.
And people being ricocheted deliberately off of things. And these aren't facilitated by structures of any kind. Right. No. They're facilitated by what, would you say?
Creativity. Boredom sometimes, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. just a desire to come up with something different that you know, haven't done before, I think.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm interested in what the adventure playground movement, if we can call it a movement, might mm-hmm. be offering that's particular to a structure. What does a structure that encourages risk-taking really actively do for kids that just an open field and maybe a lack of supervision wouldn't provide on its own?
Well, I think a lot of it is about testing limits and seeing what you can do. There's something, it's sort of like that old line about the mountain, you know, why did you climb it? Because it was there. It's that sort of attitude, you know, for kids. My six-year-old saw that rub structure in Karn's playground, and she immediately wanted to run to it. I was a little frustrated I didn't let her, but I let her get to the edges of it and actually watched her very carefully along the edges and probably, you know, being a little overprotective as a dad. My older daughters climbed on it without any issues whatsoever. But again, it's you know, learning to challenge your own limits and push yourself and push the boundaries. You know, we have a lot of these extreme sports and things, again, even on television. And I think kids probably appreciate those a lot more than parents do because they can see themselves going out and saying, can I do that?
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, you were saying that there were a couple of adventure playgrounds here in town in the 60s?
There were. There's one that's still here. They both have very interesting histories. One of them was called originally Imaginary Park. It was actually designed by Dale Eldred from Kansas City Art Institute and Elpidio Rocha, who was a local architect on the west side at 27th and Madison. People in the neighborhood called it Flintstone Park because one of the signature elements was they used these timbers, literally sort of the trunks of trees stripped of the bark that I guess to people in the neighborhood looked like large dinosaur bones from the Flintstones. Unfortunately, that park only lasted for about 4 years before I-35 was plowed through mm-hmm. the site. The other one that's actually also close to I-35 that still exists is Whitmore Playground in Kansas City, Kansas, which is on Southwest Boulevard next to Rainbow Mennonite Church. That was the site of an elementary school that was demolished in the early 70s, and the church took over responsibility for the site. And they have a perpetual agreement with the school district that they will maintain it as a playground. And they built an adventure playground there. So it has these experiential elements of, you know, sort of found objects, things like large sections of sewer pipe that kids can climb over and through. It has one of the tallest remaining, and maybe I shouldn't broadcast this too much, metal slides that you'll find anywhere in town. And I have let my young one climb up on that when she was 2 or 3 years old.
The slides that... will burn you.
third degree burns in the middle of summer. But you know, we're talking 15, 18 feet high probably. And there's also a very large, the most recent structure they've added to it is this really imaginative play fort that's shaped sort of like a pirate ship.
So we've got some good recommendations built into there from Daniel Serta on playgrounds for the non-risk averse. Tanya Blythe, what do you think might be a good playground for the risk-averse parent? Because that person exists and probably can't change overnight.
Sure, that's great. Yeah, there's support groups, we've heard. But in terms of the first playground that comes to mind, I live in the Northland, and there's a playground that just makes me batty because my kids want to go there all the time. It's Penguin Park. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've lived in Kansas City for any amount of time, you know about Penguin Park. I have
and
friends.
And you can get the story of it at KCUR.org.
Exactly. One of my favorite stories. You know, friends that grew up in Kansas City played at Penguin Park. The thing that for the risky parent, it's packed all the time, almost all the time. And it's huge. And so if you've got more than one kid, one wants to be climbing in the belly of the kangaroo and the other wants to be, going down the slide on the elephant. And it's just a moving target and you can't keep your eye on all of them.
But what about a super safe playground?
Oh, geez. Dag Park that I mentioned in North Kansas City, because it's fence enclosed, I think is one that a lot of parents would view as safe because if for some reason maybe you're watching more than one kiddo or something like that, you know they're not going to get too far. And a lot of parents really like that.
Daniel, how do communities kind of take control over what kinds of playgrounds they see in their own neighborhoods?
Well, you know, community planning, first element that I think is really important is the active participation of people within the community and trying to shape what happens. These kinds of investments are very costly and sometimes are made without any consultation with folks in the neighborhood. The great thing is that these risk concerns and liability concerns have shaped manufactured play sets that are more imaginative and a little more, quote unquote, dangerous. And so public parks departments are better able to actually create structures that more like what we're talking about.
Daniel Serta of Insight Planning, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Tanya Blythe, it's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be back tomorrow.